believe in the future. I believe in the past. I believe what you truly desire. You can bring the past. All you need is a focus and a story to hold, and the faith that you can achieve what's inside your soul. Someday we'll make it all right.
Up there, we're traveling. Traveling is the best drug. I don't care what drug you take.
Don't be telling my students to take drugs.
Well, take the drug of traveling. Take the drug of going.
Okay, just to clarify.
Take the drug of going. But
brilliance exposed.
Brilliance exposed.
Right? And that's in the exposure. Right?
That's right.
It's in the exposure.
It's in the exposure.
You have to have the interactions.
That's
you
right.
have to engage with the universe, engage with the humanity. Like, and you have to get into a state of bewilderment.
Welcome to the Home Base Podcast, the podcast where we explore the keys to college success and personal growth. I'm your host, Dr. Ricky Pope, and today we're deep diving into how students can survive and thrive in their college journey. For this first series, we're collaborating with the Young Men of Color Alliance, an organization committed to supporting young men of color through mentorship and community initiatives. Today's episode will focus on giving you the tools and strategies to take control of your academic experience. We will discuss the importance of developing agency and the power to make choices, shape your future, and overcome obstacles. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with Alexis Dixon, a Harvard-trained mediator with over 15 years of experience in conflict resolution. He believes that resolving conflict requires more than hearing grievances. It involves setting aside biases, practicing intentional listening, and finding common ground while respecting non-negotiable values. Based in San Diego, Alexis has mediated disputes for government agencies, nonprofits, Fortune 500 companies across the U.S. and abroad, utilizing humanistic psychotherapy approach to honor all parties' essential interest. Beyond his mediation practice, Alexis lectures at San Diego State University and the University of San Diego. He also leads Notes to Our Sons and Daughters, which is an art project sharing the wisdom of corporate and societal elders with future generations. His latest initiative is Brilliance Exposed, which is a photographic exhibition that presents role models of color in science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, STEAM. This exhibition features museum-quality black and white portraits of 45 diverse STEAM leaders paired with video interviews that share an amazing journey of resilience. This project addresses the underrepresentation and mental health needs of students of color in STEAM, fostering a sense of belonging, community, and wellness through mentorship and other services. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Pope. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So my first question is, what's your origin story? I know you love that question.
Yeah, I told you not to ask me that.
So. Yeah, so I had to.
You're so defiant.
Yeah,
you're so defiant. Charmingly defiant, but defiant nonetheless, you know. Yeah, my origin story. I mean, you know, my goodness, I'm Guyanese, born in Guyana, to a young mother who was 18 years old. My mother, born in Grenada. My father's Grenadian. And at 5 years old, after being born in Guyana, my mother decided to move to England and become a nurse, a physician's assistant, and eventually got a PhD. And through our travels together, ended up in high school at Madrid, lived in Italy, and had the opportunity to travel throughout the world, throughout Europe as a teenager. And so raised by a single mom was quite, particularly this mother, as I look back on her, she was quite an extraordinary, powerful woman within her own domain, within her own psychology and intellect, a very bright woman. So while in Madrid, I wanted to be a soccer player, actually. And my kneecap got dislocated during the game.
My goodness.
And so that kind of ended my career. But in short order, that's kind of a little bit about me.
What position did you play?
Forward.
Forward.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just like your daughter. Is your daughter play forward?
Yeah, she is. She recently moved up to forward. So she's been playing a goalie, defensive back, but she's itching to score goals.
And so, yeah, she's up there. So we'll see if she stays up there.
I saw her play. I had the pleasure of coming in and watching her play with you and the family. Mm. And the passion that she brings to the game. I mean, she is motivated. Mm. You're not pushing her. She's doing this.
No, I saw her.
Herself. Yeah,
yeah, like I played American football. And I was like, what's that soccer stuff over there? And I love the game. Like, I fell in love with the game because of her. So, nice. Yeah, no, it's really cool.
Yeah.
So hey, I'm interviewing you today. So listen, so you had this experience playing soccer. You had this amazing mom. You're traveling all across the world. What does it mean to be Guyanese living in America? What does that mean?
Well, it's very interesting, right? Yeah, because the thing about Guyana for me was I left there at 5 years old, mm-hmm, right, with mm-hmm, my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother and father were, again, Grenadian. Mm-hmm. And so on summer holidays. And my parents weren't married.
That's different, Guyanese versus Grenadian.
Right, okay. Right. So Guyana is part of the, right above Venezuela.
Got it.
British Guyana, Dutch Guyana, French Guyana.
Got it.
French Guyana is still French Guyana. Dutch Guyana is now Suriname. It's got its independence from the Dutch. And British Guyana is now Guyana. And so I hate to use this as a point of reference because there's so many other incredible things that makes Guyana, Guyana. But most Americans will know Guyana through the unfortunate genocide of Jim Jones and his congregation. Mm. And so when I tell people I'm from Guyana, the first thing they said is, oh, my God, Jonestown. You know, but Guyana is known for bauxite, all sorts of minerals, mm-hmm, and recently a vast discovery of oil in Guyana. Uh-oh. So I think
this is good things.
Great things. You know, should change the economic trajectory of the country, mm-hmm, and so hopefully the government in charge will, you know, utilize this economic windfall for the betterment of the country and lift all Guyanese. Mm-hmm. But to be a Guyanese in America is a very interesting thing because, you know, I have black skin. I speak with somewhat of a British accent still. Mm-hmm. I've been in America for some time. And so I'm navigating the cultural landscape of what it means to be black in America as someone who is Guyanese, Afro-Caribbean, and spent most of his young adult life in Europe. And then living in San Diego, right, which is not known in part for being an international city, right? Mm-hmm. San Diego is quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think if I'd lived in New York City or maybe Miami or even San Francisco, where there's a bit of a more international cosmopolitan kind of, you know, milieu and energy to the air, I think I would have had a different kind of experience. But to live in San Diego, where that internationalism doesn't exist, was a little bit of a difficult time for me, particularly when I first got here.
Mm-hmm. And because you're raised that way, right? Just traveling all around Europe, you're raised with this cosmopolitan kind of European environment, vibe, richness of culture, different languages, multi-language environments. And so, yeah, no, that's okay. And then I come here where there's some of that, but it's different.
Very different. You know, it's interesting because people would ask me, do you really talk like that?
Mm.
And I thought that was an odd question because, you know, when I was in high school, we always, and I had no, that wasn't a mindful thing or something that was front of mind, but we all referred to each other by place of origin.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be the American guy, you know. Mm-hmm. We'll say, oh, the American guy's coming over, the French guy's coming over, oh, the girl from Germany is coming over, right? Mm-hmm. Never skin color. Mm-hmm. So when the French guy shows up, he could be black, he could be white, he could be even Chinese, Asian, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
But there was never a sense of speaking about people in respect to color. And so when I came to California and discovered, oh, you describe and define people by color, that took me a moment. That threw me back because it's like, well, why is that the point of reference for a particular person? Because there's so much more to them than their skin color, right? The guy from Germany could be black. The guy from France could be white. The guy from, name the country, Ireland, could be Asian, right? And so where I come from and where I lived and how I was enculturated, an understanding of people not by skin color but by place of origin was a real collision with this culture here that constantly demanded that I define myself, not as a Guyanese, not as a citizen of the world, mm-hmm. but exclusively and primarily as a black man, a man mm-hmm. with black skin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it wasn't I was resist, you know, let me be honest. I was resistant to that because that was so new to me. Mm. And it was new to me because I always knew I had dark skin. That wasn't something that, you know, I look in the mirror every day. My mom is black. My father's, you know. By the way, my mother comes from a multiracial family. My mother's father is a tall Scottish guy named Forsyth. And my mother's mother is black and Indian. So if you see the family album,
get out of here.
It's from, you know, this yeah. Scottish looking man yeah. who's white to oh his goodness. Wife who is black and everybody in between. Mm. And so, you know, just from coming from a multiracial, multicultural family, living in an international world in Europe where I went to school with people who, you know, spoke several languages and their skin color was superfluous, was inconsequential to how they spoke, what they ate, where they lived, how they moved, how they sat, how they breathed, how they animated their life. And then coming here and saying, oh, no, you're not any of those. All of those are inconsequential. You're exclusively black. And as a result of that, you are now in a box. This is exactly what
so
black is.
What you're
is.
Saying is being at that time in your life, like this. So that would have been what age would that be?
When I got here?
Yeah.
20s, 21, so 22.
Early, yeah, because yeah, those are my kids. So, okay, so in your early emerge, we call it emerging adulthood, right? Because your brain doesn't connect until you're 26. That's what the theory says. And so, okay, so you're having this experience of coming to the U.S. and it's, like the way I'm hearing it, it's a sense of erasure. Like these parts of your identity are being erased, and you're being subsumed into this culture based off the way you look, based off your phenotype.
Erasure is the perfect word. I okay. never thought of it that way.
Yeah,
and what,
yeah.
what comes with that, the other word that comes with that is invisibility, denial. Mm-hmm. You know, this sense of I think the word that comes is murder. It's like psychological murder. You're like psychologically dismembered, and you're without your permission, without the person who is doing that to you or the culture that's doing that to you, care that they're dismembering you psychologically, doing so surgically and painfully. With this kind of infringement on you, there's almost this kind of psychological violence that comes with that. I'd never thought of this before until you talked about the word erasure, you know. And so, there was this psychological dismemberment of me that I was witnessing happening every day when I first got here. You know, you're not this and you're not that, and this is inconsequential. And there was this kind of dismemberment of me until at some point I recognized that in order for me to survive in this world, in this society, I had to unwillingly acknowledge that primarily my identity in this society is that I have dark skin and everything else becomes inconsequential. It's almost like watching a pile of your arms and legs and eyeballs on the ground, and you can pick it up and do whatever you want with it, but it's inconsequential in the society that you live in.
So feeling that in your early 20s, how do you, you know, move forward, persevere, love, work, live? Because that sounds like so heavy. Like that there's this sense of me that people aren't able to accept, but then somehow you just move ahead anyway. I don't understand.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's something about one's will to live. There's something about that, right, that animates you. And you see it, you don't believe it, you're in a bit of a shock. And yet the reason I came here is because my father was the first prime minister of Grenada. My father was the prime minister of Grenada and had to, that year, I think 86, had to give a talk at the UN. And while he was at the UN, Grenada was overthrown by communism. It was Cuba and Russia invaded Grenada while my father was at the UN. And at the time, Jimmy Carter was in office. And so just a bit of history, Jimmy Carter at the time had the Iranian hostage situation going on and so refused to do anything at that point about the invasion of Grenada by communism. And so my father was at the UN, without going into a very lengthy story, was at the UN in New York for a number of years, eventually came to California. And my mother called.
He wasn't able to leave.
He wasn't able to leave for a variety of reasons. Yeah, this is like a six-hour, ten-hour kind of conversation.
You know, we'll have you back to the,
Okay. And so my mother called and said, you know, here's what happened, which I already knew, and your father is going to leave New York and move to California, San Diego. Would you come and live with him? And so I left Europe and I was living at the time and came and lived with my father here. So when you ask me how did I survive that cultural shock, I came here with a mission. I came here because my father was displaced. There was a bigger narrative, a larger narrative animating me outside of the culture shock. And so having to live with my father and navigate the fact that our country was invaded by communism, and everything that went with all of that was certainly a distraction and primary to anything else. The other thing I think that helped me was I didn't plan to stay here. You know, I planned to live here for like 3-4 months, thought my father, you know, everything would go away rather handily within 3 to 6 months and I'd be back in Europe with my friends, but that never happened. It took much longer.
Okay. So it starts to kind of set in that maybe you're going to be making the U.S. home.
Well, not yet. I mean, you know, my father, you know, Jimmy Carter, you know, lost the election to Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And the hostages were then released. Mm. And then Reagan eventually turned his attention to Grenada and what was happening there. There's a wonderful piece on the internet, you can Google it, where Ronald Reagan is actually making a phone call to Margaret Thatcher, telling him that America plans to invade Grenada, and he apologizes for not letting her know ahead of time. It's a wonderful piece. You can actually Google it, Ronald Reagan calling Margaret Thatcher as he's about to invade Grenada, and that's available online. It's a wonderful conversation. But when Reagan came into office, eventually, again, a very, very long story, invaded Grenada. And the American invasion of Grenada is Ronald Reagan invading and throwing out the Cuban and Russian troops on this little tiny island called Grenada. Mm. And so it was at that time it was clear that there was a pathway for my father to go back to Grenada.
So how many, so that was 6 years?
That was about two and a half years.
2.5 years.
Yeah, yeah. So like 84, maybe, yeah, about 18 months to 2 years, 2.5 years, yeah. And in that interim time, I'm traveling back and forth for my father. Someone had, wanted to kill him. I mean, all the intrigue that goes with having a father like that. Mm-hmm, and so it wasn't clear how long it would be before it was safe for him to return to Grenada. Mm. And so eventually he returned to Grenada. I was going to leave. My mother asked me to stay in the eventuality that my father had to come back. He wouldn't have to come back and start all over again. And so I stayed here as my father went back and returned to Grenada, ran for the prime ministership of the country, won several houses in several seats in the House of Parliament, but was not successful in becoming prime minister again. And so I stayed here in the eventuality that he would have to return, which never happened. And so next thing I know, I'm here 5 years, I'm here 7 years. I'm going back and forth to Grenada for him, Canada. His health is failing at this time. And I thought, well, he's lived here for a number of years in California. I'll just bring him back to California. And that didn't happen for, again, a variety of different reasons. And eventually my father died in Grenada.
How does, I mean, that's a really extraordinary, you know, story. And I'm just wondering how that shapes your sense of identity, of manhood, of coming into who you are as a man.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think when you're growing up, your dad is just your dad, and your mom is just your mom, right? And any kind of status or celebrity or whatever it may be, just kind of, that's just who you call mom and dad. You know, my father was a difficult man. He was a high conflict man. And I tell the joke that if I said good morning to my father, I'd have to justify why it was a good morning, you know. You know. So he was that kind of guy. And as a father, he was not the nurturing kind of father. He was the guy who, you know, his love and his life was about this tiny country called Grenada. Grenada is made up of three different islands, right? Grenada, Petite Martinique, and Carriacou. Petite Martinique is French, Carriacou is Dutch, and Grenada is British, which is the largest island. So Grenada was just a little dot in the global theater, right? It's not a large landmass with a great population. But there was something about this piece of island, this piece of land, this piece of geography that my father would die for. And irrespective of its size, he always saw Grenada as consequential to the global theater. And so he had a vision for this island and its people and its culture that far exceeded the people who lived on the island at that time. You know, England did not want to relinquish Grenada. Grenada was under the rule of colonialism. My father fought for England to relinquish its oppressive colonistic rule on colonial rule on Grenada. Queen of England sent a battleship to arrest him and imprisoned him for 30 days on this little island. The British Empire sent a battleship to arrest and imprison this man on an island. I mean, is that overkill? Goodness. That's like shooting a fly with a shotgun, you know?
A battleship.
And he was on there for 30 days. And they finally released him, and Grenada became independent. So, you know, what did that teach me? It taught me that perhaps, maybe not a man, but as a human being, there are things that you have, you know, one of the things that really, and I didn't respect this or recognize this until I was much older, is that my father would die for Grenada. He would die for Grenada's independence. There was something he would die for that he so believed in. And as I got older and grew, I thought, what is that for me? What would I die for? What is so important for me that I would step into danger and give my life for it? And for my father, it wasn't family, it wasn't children, it wasn't friends. He was very much singular in his love and passion for that piece of real estate called Grenada. The Queen of England imprisoned him. He stood up to her. He brought independence to a country that oftentimes the people who lived on the island didn't want independence from England. And so he was at some point in his life a bit perplexed as to, is he really doing the right thing for the country at this time? The Queen of England and the British Empire didn't want to relinquish Grenada, all the natural resources that, you know, they took and they brought and then brought back to the island and charged the folks who grew it on their own land originally, charged them, you know, quite a bit of money for it to come back. And so I learned from him something about complexity. Something about having a vision and holding the vision and willing to die for the vision. I learned how a man like that can, at the same time, not be a father, not be close to his children, not to, you know, the kind of the Norman Rockwell dad. That gene was not in him anywhere to be found, you know. I remember when he was dying on his deathbed, I was there with a dear friend of mine who was a trained psychotherapist by Virginia Satir. And I remember her coming to Grenada and meeting my father, and my father's on the bed and he's dying. Clearly, he knows he's dying. And my friend who traveled from California actually to be with me, holding my father's hand on his deathbed and holding my hand. And she's talking to my father, who's coming in and out of consciousness. And she, the Queen also not only imprisoned my dad, but she knighted him. So my father was a sir. So she did the whole thing. You know, she said, you know, hey, look, I'm going to lock you up. You know, I'm not going to get, I'm going to take your land, but if you put up a fight, at some point I will relinquish. And she did. Mm-hmm. Grenada became independent. And 1, 2, 3 years later, she knighted him as a sir. So he was Sir Eric. So I want you to imagine, you know, my father came here, Reagan invaded, my father went back, and now my father is dying. And my friend, who's a psychotherapist, comes and she's working with me and my dad. And because I had a lot of issues around him, you know, why doesn't this man love me? All the things we asked about our father, was my dad don't love me and all that kind of nonsense. And so she's holding his hand in my hand. She said, "So Eric, your son is here and he loves you. Tell your son he loves you." And my father, I'm going to probably get a tattoo with this at some point. Mm. My father's response to that on his deathbed was, "My son knows how I feel about him." And I thought, that's the closest he could come to telling me he loves me. That's the best on his deathbed, right? You think on your deathbed, like you awaken and you're going to have this, you know, this greeting, this homecoming with Christ and your maker. And he was a very religious man. But, you know, interestingly, and I go back to what did I learn from him? I learned that... and maybe this isn't quite it, but I learned that he had certain capacity. And to be a parent is a skill set. And he just didn't, for whatever reason, have the capacity to love as a father, you know, as a father. He could love a nation. He can love a country, right? He would die for that. But when it came to this intimacy between him and his son and him and his children, I have some sisters, that was a bridge too far for him. Mm. And at some point, I recognized I had to love him because he didn't have the capacity to reach me. So I had to love him in a way that he couldn't love me. I had to love him and me through him because that was my gift to him, right? One of the things my therapist did at the time, which I thought was just marvelous for me, well, she said, you know, when I would bitch about my father, you know, being a terrible father. And I went through a phase where I really hated my father passionately. Mm. And I think as I look back on it now, I didn't hate him. What I was really doing was pining for his love. I was I called it hate, but I was really pining for his love. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying to me, and I was going on and on about this in therapy, and she said to me, "I want you to do something. I want you to see your father as a human being. I want you to see him as a man. And I want you to see him as a father." And, you know, as a human being, I mean, for the love of God, I mean, he's an expression of existence. He's an expression of the divine, as we all are, right? As a man, he has all the limitations of any man on any planet, irrespective of wealth or education or cultural or birthright or whatever it may be, right? And as a father, he just failed, you know. Mm. But having the capacity to see him and love him through these three different lenses, right? Mm-hmm. Like here he is as an expression of existence, of God, right? Mm-hmm. As a man, the magnificence of coming into the world and singularly standing up to the Queen of England and demanding that this little island of black people, right, be independent and make their own decisions about their future. It was something to marvel at because he came from poverty. His parents were poor. He didn't come from wealth. Mm-hmm. But that as a father, I just couldn't give him anything above an F, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when I looked at that, the ability to forgive him, the ability to love him, the ability to discover his humanity, his ability, I've got a dear friend, Steve Garber, who's an Aikidoist and a poet, and he always tells me, you know, Aikido is not about hurting the other person as much as primarily and foundationally moving the person in such a way that you get to see their point of view, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of disarming the person from hurting you and both, hurting you or them, right? Mm-hmm. And I had to do this kind of emotional Aikido, you know, which, you know, as I called it emotional Aikido, I had to forgive him. I had to forgive him and forgive me at the same time in order to love him, in order to find him, in order to not primarily be angry with him, but to discover the limitation of the man. And in doing that, I discovered how lonely my father was, how terrified he must have been at times, that to love a son might have been too much in a world where his country wasn't free. He came from poverty. The Queen of England imprisoned him. He had a vision for the country that no one else at the time had. Mm. And the singularity of that, and asking someone who holds so much of existence and so much of the world outside themselves, in addition to loving a son, might have been asking too much for any one individual. And I realized that, did my father need to be perfect for me to love him? You know, did he have to live up to this ideal in order for me to love him? And was there space to forgive him? Now, it doesn't mean it didn't hurt when all those things were, you know, what was happening as his son, you know. But at the end of the day, I chose to love him in a way that he couldn't love himself. Mm. And that was my gift to him and to me.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. You know, I don't even know what to say.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story about that brought me a lot of grief. When I would go to Grenada, when my father was prime minister, I would, I knew everybody in politics at the time, and there was a lovely Senator Brenda Hood, who was in the House of Parliament at the time, and she and I were dear friends, and she loved my father. And I would say, hey, I'm coming to Grenada. And she said, okay, I want you to bring this, this, and this, and bring this for this nonprofit, and bring this literature for this other nonprofit. So I would pack up a suitcase, two suitcases of literature and cell phones and fax machines and all that stuff. And when I landed, I would then, before I even went to the hotel or went home, I would stop at all these nonprofits and this is for you and this is for you. So I'd hit like 3, 4, 5 nonprofits. So one time she called me and she said, there's a young chap that started an after-school program, and would you bring all these after-school materials for him and all that, in addition to the other things. So I landed in Grenada, and my typical thing, I go to all the nonprofits, and my last stop was with this young chap she had told me about. So I go in, and there's this young, handsome kid, maybe 21, very poised, very composed for his age. And we sat down and talked, and I said, you know, Senator Hood asked me to bring these things for you, and you've got to have this after-school program, and how lovely, and you're such a young age. What fostered this? What gave you this sense of community? And he goes, well, you know, my true story, my father died, and this man just came and, you know, took care of my mom and took care of us and has made it possible for, you know, me to have a mentor. And now that my father's gone, he's essentially became a father to me. I love him. And I said, how wonderful is that? Who is this man? And the man was my father. Can I be honest with you?
Get out of here.
When he told me that, really honestly, and he didn't know. He didn't know who I was. Yeah. So when he told me that, the first thing I thought was, I want all my stuff back.
Yeah.
I want, give me all my, everything I brought, give it to me.
I'm going home. And I'm not playing with you.
I'm not playing with you. Yeah. Give me all my stuff back, and on the way out, I'm going to break your leg.
Yeah.
You know, here's this kid telling me how lovely and nurturing my father was to him. And I got to tell you, it took me a moment, and I don't know what happened because I was quite young. And in that moment, from abject rage and anger, I don't know if God held my hand. I don't want to get mystical and woo-woo, but something washed over me, and that is, oh, my father can't love in an intimate way. He knows how to love in, I don't want to say a transactional kind of way, but the further away you are from him, the easier it is for him to love you, because he can love you and leave. He can love on you and leave. And I thought, how wonderful that here is a man who can't love me the way Norman Rockwell tells me and Hallmark tells me and my culture tells me that he should love me. But here he is loving a young boy who had a loss. And here's what this young boy is doing for the community. And there is something about the rage and the anger I felt towards this chap, this young boy, that kind of went away. And I don't know where I got that from. And I still have that today. I haven't lost it. And I didn't have to struggle with it. But that saved me. Whatever, wherever that came from, wherever that emotional gem, that emotional gift came from, to say, you know, in loving him, look at what this kid is doing for the island, saved me from falling into maybe a depression or an anger with, you know, deeper anger with my dad. But that was one of the occasions I had to hear someone say to me, look how great your dad can love a kid.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, great. Lovely. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, that brings me to one of my questions here. You know, I just really appreciate your stories and what you're sharing and how that's going to help listeners understand their stories and then the lives that we lead. So I guess just what would be a piece of advice that you would give the students to help them navigate conflict in, you know, maybe academic and personal settings?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to recognize life is difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Life is difficult for everybody. That's the democracy of life, right? I don't think you can say life or existence without conflict, right? I would even say existence is conflict. And then I would say to them, now that we know that's the democracy, irrespective of, you know, class, birthright, birthplace, socioeconomic strata, right? Irrespective of all of that, if you're pretty, if you're tall, if you're fat, if you're thin, if the universality of existence is, life is difficult, you know? And one of the things I say is that everybody has a broken leg. Right? I mean that metaphorically. So my broken leg might be depression. The other person's broken leg, maybe my dad was not a good dad. The other person's broken leg is I was in an orphanage. The other person's broken leg is I was abused as a child. The other person's broken leg might be I was molested as a child. The other person, we all have this metaphorical broken leg. And so now that we know that life is difficult, that existence and conflict is synonymous, the question is now, how do we accept and invite? Very hard to do, and I don't want to make poetic language here, but for me, conflict is an invitation. Conflict is an invitation. It's an invitation to bring out the worst in me, or it's an invitation for me to have some empathy, right? I think of Azim Kamisa, who I love and admire. And his son, unfortunately, was murdered by a young 14-year-old. And one night, we're having dinner together. And he forgave the boy who murdered his son, visited him in jail.
What are you talking about? Stop, wait, slow, like rewind. Wait, what?
Yeah. He lives in San Diego. His name is Azim Kamisa. And he is a lovely, gorgeous, spiritual man who got a phone call maybe 30 years ago, that his son, who actually came to San Diego State, was a student at San Diego State University, pizza delivery boy, someone ordered a pizza, and when his son showed up, who happened to be working part-time at this pizza delivery place, without going into a long story, and he, of course, can tell the story much better than I can because it's his story.
Yeah.
A 19-year-old boy told a 14-year-old boy to essentially murder the pizza delivery boy, a boy he had never met. And this 14-year-old boy pulled the trigger and, again, without going into all the details of the story, murdered Azim's son. And so Azim, again, without going into a lot of the details, was able to forgive this 14-year-old boy that murdered his son. 3 months prior, California had passed a law stating that 14-year-olds can be tried as adults. So unfortunately for this little boy who committed this unspeakable act, and of course, for you to be 14 and do that meant you came from a kind of an emotional deficit and an emotional desert kind of environment, right, generally speaking. And for this little boy, it was. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Azim found a way to forgive Tony. And Tony then, because of the law that was passed 3 months earlier, had to go to adult prison. And Azim went and visited him throughout the time he was in prison. He had to do 25 years, I believe. Azim wrote a couple of books. Tony wrote the foreword to the book. Azim convinced him to finish his high school degree, I think convinced him to do some years of college. And when Tony was released from prison, I think some 3, 4, 5 years ago, asked Tony to come and work for his nonprofit organization. Azeem had founded a nonprofit organization, the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, in name of his son, and goes to schools and talk to kids about violence and forgiveness and that kind of thing. So one night, and this is a vast story, but to the question of how do you navigate conflict, one night I was with Azeem and we were having dinner and talking, and he said, oh, I said, what did you do today? He goes, I had a wonderful day. I was with Tony. And he's charming and he's smart and he knows politics. And this kid is, he's flirting with the waitress. And I just love this kid. And I paused, and I'm looking at the man who is talking about the boy that murdered his son. I was with Tony this morning, the boy who murdered my son. And I love him. We had breakfast and he was flirting and with the waitress and we're talking about politics. And he's like so bright. I love him. Mm. And at some point in the evening, I looked at Azeem and I said, it's just you and I, it's just you and I. How were you able to forgive Tony? And he said two things that have stayed with me and changed my life. He said, if I hadn't, would you want to have dinner with me right now? If I hadn't forgiven Tony, would you really want to have dinner? Do you know what this dinner would be like? And he said, the second thing is, I don't agree that Tony should have killed my son. I don't agree with that at all. He said, but every night I go to bed, I weep for my son. I weep for Tariq. I weep for Tariq. I'm not going to see him graduate from San Diego State. I'm not going to see him have grandchildren. I'm not going to. He said, but I also weep for Tony. I weep for Tony as well. And, here's a kid who came from a family that didn't nurture him, didn't love him, and he found his way into a gang and he did something that was quite awful. And so how do you navigate conflict? First of all, you recognize that there is a broken heart. Existence in part is a relationship of a broken heart. Mm-hmm. And that existence will break your heart, but you will also break the heart of existence. Right? I will do things to break people's hearts, and people will do things to break my heart as well. Mm. And so the broken heart is an open heart. My heart is open. Now, that doesn't mean that you participate in your own oppression. This is not an invitation to do that, but it's an invitation to acknowledge that the truth of existence is that it's a journey of a broken heart. Mm. It's a narrative of a broken heart. And if my heart is broken, you and I are sitting here. We're talking. I know a bit about your history. I know what it took for Dr. Pope to sit in front of me right now and be a professor and the journey and the twists and turns that it took. I know that your heart has been broken. Mm. I know that if I saw you maybe at 14 and 17 and 20, I would not think you would be a Dr. Pope. Right?
Facts.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so here you sit. And so the broken heart is a narrative of existence. And I would say again, conflict is an invitation for two ways. One is to be angry and weaponize your anger. Mm-hmm. The other thing is to be angry and do something good with the anger. And anger, I would submit, again, is an invitation. It's an invitation to self-discovery. My father did not love me the way I wanted him to love me, right? Mm. Norman Rockwell and Hallmark told me, here is how a father loves a son. The culture informed me, here's how a father loves a son. That was not my experience with my father. And I had two choices. I could hate him, right? Right? Because he wasn't giving me the things I want. There's only one person I call father. There's 9 billion people in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's only one of the 9 billion people I call father. Mm-hmm. And that one person who could give me what he could didn't. Mm-hmm. And I could be angry about that. Or I could accept the invitation to discover why he's not. And what I discovered in that, when I took that path of discovery, was that he simply didn't have the capacity to do it. It didn't mean it didn't hurt. It didn't mean I didn't pine for his love. But my invitation to not weaponize my anger against my father and be angry with all existence led me to not only understand him, but to love him and to make a decision, I will not be that kind of father, right? I will be not kind of. So it is in forgiveness. It's in forgiving ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And in forgiving existence, like forgiving existence itself, that we find each other in our common humanity. How do I forgive existence for breaking my heart? Not that I won't protect myself, not that I won't do things to make the world a better place and myself a better place, and not that existence isn't difficult, but in the invitation that conflict brings to me, it can invite me to weaponize my anger and be a menace to society, to use that language, right? Or conflict, I can accept the other invitation from conflict to look at it, protect myself from it, not go back into environments that will harm me, and at the same time ensure that I become a conduit to not behave that way. In Azeem Kamisa forgiving Tony, Tony came out and he's now part of Azeem's organization, and he stands on stage and says, "Hi, my name is Azeem Kamisa. This is Tony. He murdered my son, and I love him. And I love him." What do you do with a broken heart? A broken heart is an invitation to love. It's an invitation to look at existence squarely in the eye and say, "Hi, existence. Thank you for my being an expression of who you are, and I choose to love you and love you and love you and be in awe of you and to co-create with you. And in the pain and the heartache and the heartbreak, I will add more beauty to the world. I will not weaponize my heartache. I will not weaponize my heartbreak." Right? I think that's the offering. And I think it is in that narrative we find our common humanity. Will we die? Yes. Will we kill each other? We do. Do we break each other's hearts? We do. Is there beauty in the sunset? Has a stranger done something lovely for you? Have you done something lovely for a stranger? Have you had a bad day when someone said the right thing to you at the right time and kept moving, right? And so I say, on the street of existence, on the street of existence, look both ways before you cross the street. I look to the right and I see the horrors of the world and I weep. And as I move my gaze from the right all the way over to the center, I continue to weep at the horrors. And as I get to the middle and I move over, I see the beauty, the inexplicable beauty of existence. And I continue to weep because I see magic in the world. And that is existence. That is existence. We have to, if we're going to shift the world, we have to, each of us, fall deeply in love with existence, be in awe of existence, and choose to co-create for the betterment of mankind. And that is heavy, heavy, heavy lifting. So to all the students on campus, I'll sum this up. Life is difficult, but life is enormously elegant, and you have a choice. You can weaponize your anger and say how terrible life is and how awful it is. And that's true. Or you can look at life and say how terrible and how awful life is and how angry you are about it and choose to do something good.
Yeah, as I listen to you in the story that you're telling me, there's duality. Like, and that seems to be a reoccurring theme in your work. And so looking at art and storytelling notes to our sons and daughters, which seeks to capture wisdom from leaders throughout art, and really that seems to be an intergenerational kind of project. So duality yet again, how do you think art can be a catalyst for personal, societal growth, especially for students?
Yeah, I think art is that thing. It's that place, right, that gives expression. You know, I always say sometimes we ask language, words to do things it can't do. You know, if you know, if, for example, if someone was an alien and they came down here and said, "Hey, I see you guys eat apples. I'm Dr. Pope. Can you tell me what an apple tastes like?" you know, it's beyond words, right? So I think sometimes we ask words to do things it can't do. And I think that's where art comes into play. It's beyond words. It's experiential. You have to have the experience. Mm. And once I look at the Mona Lisa, once I look at what's the brother that's doing all the art right now? I'm blanking on his name. I'll tell you his name. But the brother who's doing, he did the portrait of Barack Obama. And I'm blanking on his name. But once I look at a piece of art or hear a piece of music by Miles Davis or, something that just moves me, that's what art is. It brings me into an experience that's beyond words and beyond narrative. So what I would say to students on campus, is to find a way to express yourself that is beyond language, beyond narrative, whether it's through relationships with people that disagrees with you, whether it's through painting and art and music and rap or, I love this one video where Pavarotti and James Brown did It's a Man's World. Pavarotti had called up James Brown's people and said, hey, Pavarotti wants to do this song with James Brown, It's a Man's World. And they go like, well, how is that going to go? He said, oh, Pavarotti's going to sing it in Latin. And the response by James Brown's people was, well, nobody knows Latin. And Pavarotti's people said, exactly, we'll make it up. And if you haven't seen Pavarotti and James Brown saying it's a man's world.
Oh, yeah, no, it's...
Kills it.
Yeah, it's
right?
Beautiful.
Yeah. So, how do you do it? It's not linear. Yeah, for students, you find ways. You try, you experiment, you try different things, whether it's writing or art or traveling. Traveling is the best drug. I don't care what drug you take.
Don't be telling my students to take drugs.
Take the drug of traveling. Take the drug of going. But... self-expression and pushing yourself. Pushing yourself, learning, asking questions, sitting with Dr. Pope, asking him if after class you can meet with him, ask him about his life, interview him. So there's so many, but art is that thing that goes beyond language, beyond narrative, and it's a way for you to bring an experiential aspect to your life that otherwise language just can't give to you. So there has to be a place where, and that happens in relationship.
So what's a memorable piece of wisdom from Notes to Our Sons and Daughters that's had a lasting impact on you?
Oh, wow. Well, so many people said so many different things. I'm thinking of Deborah Seki. I'm thinking of, my gosh, Milan Burnham. I'm thinking of Jesse Knight. I'm thinking of, Michelle Larocque. I'm thinking about, Sydney Seow, who talked about a broken heart is an open heart and how she felt after the death of her father. I think what I learned is that wisdom... Mary Walshock told me that, actually. I think it was Mary Walshock who said to me, when I think of wisdom, wisdom is not singular, it's in the collective, right? And so the idea of when I think of wisdom, it is that place where we meet. There is no gender, there is no space, there is no time. It's all that's always been known. And if we say to me, wisdom and brilliance is almost synonymous, it's that place where if I said to you, okay, Dr. Pope, let's sit in our wisdom, and let's talk from our wisdom, let's co-create from our wisdom. There is no space, there is no time. And you know those moments when you fall into a group with students and you look, oh my God, it's 3 o'clock, we've been here 5 hours, right?
Yeah.
There is no you and there is no me, right? There's this movement from the one, from the me to the we to the oneness, right? And so for me, wisdom isn't singular. It's an invitation for us to meet in that place where there is no me, there is no other, right? And that can come from anywhere because you've got children. And I'm sure your little four-year-old has said some things to you and think, okay, how old are you? How old are you? Where did that come from, right?
Yeah. From the universe.
From the universe. Yeah. There you go. From that which is, that which animates. So the wisdom thing for me is where we deconstruct the other.
You've had a a range in your career. And so there's the mediation and conflict, and we have those students who are training in conflict and mediation on campus. So there's a program for that. So I would like to see what kind of career advice you'd give to students on that track. And then also as an artist, and definitely an artist, because I'm like, where do you even start to take some of this stuff and fashion a career out of it? So kind of both areas, like conflict mediation, how do you get started there, and or any insights, and then also for the art trajectory?
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. One is, you know, serendipity. You know, sometimes you just get lucky and fall into something. Mm. You know, I've got friends who majored in zoology that works for the FBI. You know, I've got friends who have, you know, there's a guy in New York who studied all his life to be a lawyer. Now he has this amazing cupcake shop where he sells cupcakes. I met a lovely man. His name is Reggie Van Lee. And Reggie Van Lee is a hugely successful individual in America, African American, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him. And he told me something that changed my life. He said, you know, when I was growing up, my mother always told me, have a plan A for your life and work very, very, do the due diligence, do the work. And if your plan A doesn't materialize, I love this language, you forgive yourself. If you forgive yourself, and then you go to your plan B. And oftentimes it turns out your plan B was better for you than your plan A, right? So I think we all, you know, we go to college and we have a trajectory of what we're going to be, what we're going to do, and we're going to change the world. And next thing you know, you're over here doing something. And oftentimes when you speak to very successful people, they'll tell you, you know, what I wanted to have accomplished in my life, thank God I didn't, because here I am, right? Mm-hmm. So for students going into conflict resolution, the first thing is to look at it as a business. Really, really get a minor and get a business minor and look at any discipline, whether it's conflict resolution or not, whether it's psychology, history, art, look, get a business minor. Look at it as you can always work for someone else. You can always be part of a group, part of a team, but you're going into life into a business. If you're a criminology major, look at it as a business. You can always work for an organization, a company. That's the first thing. And the second thing I would say is to think of yourself as an artist. Huh. Think of yourself as an art. If you're a criminologist, call your office your studio. If you're a psychologist, call your artist a studio.
I'm going to call mine the home-based studio lab.
Yeah, call your office a studio and look at it through that lens. And what it does, it broadens and it kind of blows it out of a silo. Right? Because if I'm a criminologist, this is what I am and this is what I do. So if you see this as an entrepreneur, I'm going into the business of criminology, I'm going into the business of psychology, I'm going into the business of conflict resolution. And then you do the work to lay the groundwork for that to happen. And then the second thing is refer to your office as a studio. And through that lens, you bring all those things, both visible and invisible. You bring a creative lens into the work you do.
Okay. What's the most valuable lesson you've learned from someone you consider a mentor or role model?
I think to fall in love with existence. Yeah. I think to fall completely in love with all of life, the things I like, the things I don't like, the hopes, the dreams, the disappointments, the joyful moments, the moments of innovation and success. Mm. Because ultimately you'll die physically, you know, as we define death in this society. So if I'm going to die and existence is a gift, I mean, here you and I are sitting in a studio having a podcast on a big round thing that's floating in space with nothing holding it up. Let's just have a cup of coffee and think about that for a few minutes. Yeah. You know? So I think to just, not that you like everything that happens to you. You know, some of us have been abused. There's a war going on. Name all the things that are happening in the world that we don't like, and yet here we are. You know, this is existence in its most elegance and its most, you know, frightening moments, where we look and go, why haven't we gotten to a place yet where we are saying, do you remember when we used to kill each other. Do you remember that? Do you remember back in those days when we used to kill each other? Do you remember when we used to hate each other? Do you remember when we used to treat each other badly? Mm-hmm. We're still doing that with all the technology we have. So we can't outsource our humanity. We cannot outsource. Our humanity is our own to engage in, unfold, co-create with, and it's messy and it's painful. So the most, I think the best piece of advice I got was at some point to fall in love with existence in all its heartbreaks. And that, again, the broken heart is an open heart. And the fact that my heart is broken is not an invitation to weaponize my anger, but to use my anger as use the energy of my anger to hopefully, I'm not always successful, by the way, to make life a better place. I mean, I'm constantly learning that. And the second thing is forgiveness. I love what Reggie Van Lee said to me when he said, you know, my mother told me, if you are working very hard to accomplish your plan A and you don't achieve it, forgive yourself. So self-forgiveness is huge. You're not perfect. Perfection should not be a measure for you to love yourself. Excellence, on the other hand, is gorgeous. Live a life of excellence because you're always refining. I had the pleasure of being at Google some years ago in Mountain View, and I was on campus. I've been there several times, fortunately. And they have this long, white, dry eraser board. And in the middle of it, somebody had made a big circle and wrote in the middle of that, refine the process. And I just love that because life is an ongoing refinement, an ongoing curiosity about how can I do this better? How can I do this more creatively? How can I really be the best, the most excellent of who I am?
See, in my work with creatives, I find that, like, them giving themselves the permission to refine, right? Like, because sometimes it's hard to get started, or where do I even start? So just do it messy, just get started, and you can refine, right? And just kind of that freedom to create and refine. So, no, that's a gift.
Well, I thought also, if I can just add, you know, I caught Leonardo da Vinci last night, right? And with refinement comes curiosity, right? Because I cannot say, how do I refine without being curious, right? And so this perpetual curiosity, and it goes back to my relationship with existence, how much of my time is spent in awe of existence? How curious I am about who you are and who I am and what makes us, what animates this thing called existence. So in order to refine, it demands a perpetual curiosity.
Yeah, the way I'm hearing it in my mind is like, what would it be like to be in a state of bewilderment about existence? Like,
oh my God, can you imagine?
Yeah.
So if we said, hey, let's, in family and friends and relationship and community within the corporate sector, the nonprofit sector, universities, let's live in bewilderment for a moment. Let's live in not knowing and just searching. In England, when you go to the Tube in London, there's something that says mind the gap. And it's between the platform and the train, right? And what I always love is it doesn't say be careful, watch out, danger. It doesn't say that. It says mind the gap. Bring your mind into the gap, right? And if when you talk about being bewildered, is can we bring our mind into awe, into wonderment, into what if, into refinement. Let's you and I sit here, not be perfect, but let's sit in refinement of each other.
What's, you can only give me one, one book, film, or piece of art that has profoundly influenced your worldview and why?
The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck.
Ah, it's one of my favorites. Is that right? Tell me more.
The book begins with life is difficult.
Yeah.
It's the first line of the book.
Yeah.
Life is difficult. Let's sit with that for a moment. Life is conflict. You know, life has pain, has texture, has all possibilities. Life is, and I just love it. And then there's a part of the book where he talks about love as a behavior. And I really love that. He takes it out of the romantic and put it into the behavioral. If somebody tells you they love you, that's me telling you I love you. But the way you know I love you is because I behave lovingly, right? The way I know myself, if I love myself, is I behave lovingly. It goes back to the refinement. So that book just really stayed with me for whatever reason. Mm. And I think it had to do with the very first line, life is difficult. Mm. And then there's a chapter, I think it's the last chapter, on grace. Mm. And that's something we don't talk about very much. You know, a couple of things we don't talk about in modern culture is grace, wisdom, right? Brilliance, mm-hmm. right? Invitation to co-create mm-hmm. in love. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't talk about these things. We become a little too transactional. And so we have, in the transactionality of existence, we have compromised a bit of our humanity, which is what we're seeking.
And even talking about brilliance, that makes me think of your latest project, Brilliance Exposed, which yeah. is a photographic exhibition that presents role models of color in science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. That's STEAM, I believe.
Yes.
And so this exhibition, there's photos, there's portraits. You've interviewed 45 STEAM leaders across the nation or the world.
The nation.
Across the nation. Yeah. I'm going to say the world. Okay. It's going to grow. It's going to grow.
Yeah.
It's going to grow. And you're really trying to understand like their work, their stories, their life journeys, and how they contribute to science, mathematics, art. Tell me about Brilliance Exposed.
Yeah, Brilliance Exposed came about. There was a professor at UCSD named Dr. Gentry Patrick, who was mm-hmm. born in South Central, found his way to what's the university now? I think I'm getting tired. found his way to a university up in LA, and then eventually ended up at Harvard. Mm. Berkeley, found his way to Berkeley, ended up at Harvard, and got a PhD in neuroscience. It's now a full chair in neuroscience at UCSD. Mm. And so I was on a foundation. Bob Copeland was the president of the foundation, and came to a meeting, a board meeting, just overjoyed having met this young African-American scientist and wanted to meet him. So we met Dr. Gentry Patrick, got to know him, donated and gifted him with $250,000 to start a PATH Scholars Program mm-hmm. at UCSD. Mm-hmm. And so he invited me to come and talk to the students. And so when I got there, I saw these little black and brown nerds in this class, and I was just taken by them. Mm-hmm. So after meeting with them a few times on the drive home, I thought I'd love to do something to support them. And one of the things, as you know, students of color in science and STEM oftentimes are the only ones in their class. Their professors are usually, typically, a white male professor. And I think most insidiously, they don't see themselves in their textbook, right? So there's no role models for them. So I'm driving home and I thought, why don't I do something for these students? And so I decided to create a photographic exhibition featuring exclusively men and women of color in STEM. And this grew from doing it locally to doing it nationally. And it has been a joy to take on a project like that. And, you know, you and I are talking about collaborating with this particular project here on SDSU.
Yeah, I just think it's an exhibit worth seeing, you know, the energy and the work that you've put into it. But just in this moment when you were talking about, you know, being in the sciences or in a STEAM class and being like one of the only people and there's no one that looks like you, and just the importance of this work, right? Like I remember, you know, being at a predominantly white institution and not seeing anybody. I was a criminal justice major and nobody, you know, looked like me. I think there was one other African-American male in my 300, you know, person class. And so I'm just thinking about students. Like I recently gave a presentation to, I think it was the MARC program, and I think there was maybe like one or two African American and students in the program, and all different, you know, minorities and ethnicities, you know, in there. But what is it? But then they go out into the larger, you know, and so what would it be like to see this STEAM exhibit, to see Brilliance Exposed, and to see like if that was a part of their curriculum, or if that was in partnership with one of the research conferences, I could just really see that being a way to inspire those students to see a trajectory of these high profile, high level scientists, but then to see the sometimes humble beginnings of where they start, and it's like, okay, well, damn, they overcame all that. I could do this. or I see someone that looks like me, or I'm going to model my life from these aspects of their life. And so I think that's the true power of art, and why I'm really hoping to collaborate with you on this exhibit and hopefully, you know, get more eyes on it, because it sounds really inspirational.
Yeah, I'm really, first of all, excited to work with you on this project because of your experience and the energy you bring to it and the brilliance and intellect and personal, your personal journey that you bring to it. But, you know, even though it's an exhibition of men and women of color, it's very much a human story. Mm-hmm. You know, you listen to some of the things that some of these men and women have overcome. I mean, you know, the Chinese talk oftentimes about something being narrow at the front and broad in the back, right? We're telling the story, for example, of Hakim Alawisi, who's president of the Astrophysics Society of America. Hakim was addicted to crack cocaine as a junior in college, you know, and he fell off, you know, lost his way, and finally got back on track. Came out of a home where crack cocaine and abuse was, you know, prominent in his life. I mean, this guy, again, speaking about conflict being an invitation. And this man who's the president, in fact, he talks about this openly, so I'm not outing my boy, right? Mm-hmm. There's actually going to be a movie made about him at some point. Mm-hmm. But here's a guy who's president of the Astrophysics Society of America, having a very painful, very twisted. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also a story about not giving up on people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had seen him at maybe 10, if you'd seen him as a junior, addicted to crack cocaine, falling away from his studies and all that. And again, he tells the story much more elegantly than I can. And again, after going through this very human, right, slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, he's now the president of the Astrophysics. Brilliant. So again, it's very much a human story.
Yeah, no, and I think... yes, absolutely. And how those stories are universal. So it's making me think of one of my favorite movies, which I guess is a book. It's October Sky, and it's based on this book called Rocket Boys, where there's this young man, Homer Hickman, and he's a coal miner's son. And he was inspired by reading about the first Sputnik launch, and he takes up rockets, right? And so it's a real inspirational movie, and you watch him iterate throughout the whole movie of how to get these rockets to shoot up in the sky. And so when I'm listening to some of the stories that you're telling and about this invitation to co-create and to, for me, I just say, just get started, right?
Yeah.
Like, and then we'll figure it out along the way. So you're making me think of that movie and that kind of that narrative. And that's, I think it's a universal story.
And you also learn, you know, you're talking about Dr. Sylvester Gates, who brought supersymmetry to MIT, right? Mm-hmm. And how did that happen? Mm-hmm. His mom had a favorite movie actor that she really liked, packed the kids up one day to go see this movie. And he comes back and he can't stop talking about space and about rockets, right? He's like 6 years old. Right? And his dad, he tells me the story of his dad being so taken by his young son, being so animated by this movie, that the dad went out and got him comic books about rockets and space and that kind of things, because he never used to like to read. And so now he's reading this whole series of comic books, and eventually he becomes...
Yeah, no, listen, now I'm brilliance exposed.
Brilliance exposed.
Right? And that's in the exposure. Right?
That's right.
It's in the exposure. You have to have the interactions.
That's
you have to engage with the universe, engage with the humanity. Like, and you have to get into a state of bewilderment. And it sounds like it's beautiful when it's authentic.
When it's authentic.
It just authentically happens. Yeah. And I'm bewildered by this. And I want to, oh my gosh, I can't put this down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it speaks to access. Mm-hmm. It speaks to inclusivity. Mm-hmm. On Hidden Brain, last Sunday, they were talking about certain... a certain species of grapes in France dying out because it had been infected by this particular insect.
Oh my.
And because it was just no diversity within the grape vines.
No, this is what's fascinating about what you're saying. Like, if we really deconstruct just this sentence that you just said, right? Like, some scientists went to college, had to spend their life learning those techniques to study these insects that are affecting these grapes.
Right,
right. Right? Like, that's, whoa.
But what they figured out was they were going to lose their entire vineyard had they not graft American grapes. So they had to create diversity.
Wow.
Within the grape, the vineyard, in order to survive. And so the idea of access, the idea of inclusivity, the idea of diversity of thought, diversity. So all of that speaks to what happens. Again, it goes back to the very much of a human story. Mm-hmm. We cannot separate ourselves from each other as much as we'd like to think we are. So again, although this idea of brilliance exposed, and it's a play on words, it's exposing your brilliance. Are you invited to expose your brilliance? Can you authorize yourself? If not invited, can you
photograph me, put me on camera? Do you think my story is worth telling?
Exactly.
Right? Like, how many times do we shrink down, right?
That's right. But we cheat ourselves and we cheat the world when we shrink down. We rarely do, because we don't give the best of who we are. And oftentimes, when you give the best of who you are, we look for empirical evidence that has been received. And oftentimes, there are times when you give the best of who you are, there's no empirical evidence that it's received until 100 years after you die.
You got it.
Right? And somebody goes, what happened? How did that come up? Well, you know, this guy 100 years ago did this and did that. So I think we give the best of who we are because it's our relationship with humanity that demands that. You know, and when we don't, we all lose. Mm-hmm. Right? We all lose something.
All right. Well, listen, this is another episode of the Home Base Podcast. What are the closing words that you want to say?
Oh, my God. No pressure, huh? You want me to say something?
You can close us out.
And the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on. You know, that reminds me of a student. Oh, man, it was phenomenal film. If I ever get the chance to do a film festival, I have to get this film in there. I can't remember the exact name of it, but they played that song in there. It was about a African American male who was deaf, and he was coming out of the library or studying, and he has this interaction. It was really good, and the student led project. I did some like diversity consulting on the project, but their song was that, and the beat goes on.
Yeah,
it was really good.
Yeah.
So you made me think of that.
Nice. Thanks for this opportunity to come
Absolutely.
And talk to you, man.
Pleasure.
I hope I said something that meant anything.
I think you did. I think you did. I think I think the students will be touched, and the listeners, broadly defined, will learn something from this.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And thank you for who you are. I know that I've known you long enough to know that when you show up, you know, fully present. And I've learned that from you. So thank you for who you are and what you give to the students and to our friendship. It means a lot to me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, brother.
All right. Home Base Podcast. Peace. The Home Base Podcast is a student success podcast recorded at the Digital Humanities Center at San Diego State University Library. Like, follow, subscribe. Find us on IG at SDSU_homebase.